Cinema Sleuths. I'm Adam Cook.
I'm Kurt Walker.
And I'm Duncan Gray.
And Duncan was actually intended to be our co-host from the very beginning of this podcast, and it has taken until the third episode for him to join us just through sheer circumstance, but he's the man we wanted from the very beginning. He's the apple of our eyes. And he works for movie.com. He's our superior, our lord, our commander. So, without further ado, Duncan Gray.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going very well.
Are you still recuperating from Cannes fatigue?
Definitely. Cannes fatigue, just the basic schedule of Cannes was described for me as basically meeting, film screening, meeting, late night party, go to bed at 4 a.m., get 4 hours of sleep, wake up and do it again for about a week straight.
Right.
Which
did you have a lot of choosing what movies you saw?
Actually, for working at Cannes, one of the hardest things to do is to see a movie.
Yeah,
it's actually, I didn't see a movie until my third day. I was kept out of both Lynn Ramsey's We Need to Talk About Kevin and Gus Van Sant's Restless. The latter because I showed up to the Gus Van Sant only an hour in advance instead of an hour and a half.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, Cannes is an absolutely dizzying place. It's somewhere between, it's sort of like straddling the line between euphoria and really, really sore feet. You know, you're just sort of running around all day trying to catch as much as you can. You know, opening up a guide of all these films and, trying to pick films and you know, because I always love walking into a movie without knowing anything about it, but at Cannes it's almost a risky proposition because you could end up with Antichrist.
Yeah.
So a lot of, you know, one of the great thrills of Cannes is going into a movie that you know nothing about and finding it really, really good.
Right.
And in fact, even the movies that aren't so good are still very much fun to see because you are at Cannes.
Yeah, should we start with that question then?
So did that happen to you where you walked into something you didn't know what to expect and it ended up being a really good movie?
Yes. The movie that was The Unexpected Pleasure, and we can get to the expected pleasure in due time, and I'm sure we will, was
a
film by Gerardo Naranjo called Miss Bala.
Yeah.
And right, yeah.
It's the one that's like, it's just every scene's in one shot kind of thing, and it plays with visual space and whatnot.
Oh, very much so. It's basically, what the film is about is it's about a young woman in Mexico who enters a beauty pageant, and she ends up getting drawn into Mexico's drug wars, at where she ends up basically the basic MO of the film are sort of incredibly tense set pieces where she cannot be anything but a passive observer just hanging on for dear life, and it unfolds in something that feels very much, each scene feels like real time and is done at least for the first half in as few shots as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives this the film a very mesmerizing rhythm, and as the war escalates, it becomes very, very wonderfully disorienting.
Mm-hmm.
You really can't tell who's on whose side, which is exactly the point. And in fact, one scene, a gun battle, the camera is just fixed on her cowering in the driver's seat of a car as pretty much all the shots happen off screen. That's another thing about Cannes. It has absolutely amazing sound systems.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah, the clip of that film I watched is pretty stunning.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Definitely going to see that.
Yeah.
Hopefully it comes to VIF.
Yeah, definitely check it out.
Yeah. So were there any other surprises like that then?
A lot of it was mostly just a lot of discovery. You know, it made me realize how much current cinema I'm missing. As I have said, in 2010, I saw more silent films than 2010 films, so I've been trying to catch up on the past. And
right.
This was sort of a chance to start seeing all the great work that's being done in the present. I saw my first film by Nanni Moretti here. He won he won the Palme d'Or 10 years ago.
And how was that movie?
It was good. It's called Habemus Papam, which is Latin for "We have a Pope."
Yeah.
And it is a satire of Catholicism, where a veteran priest gets picked to be the new pope, and is so panicked by this spiritual responsibility that he runs away and spends the film sort of experiencing the world outside the conclave. And I wouldn't say it's a fully successful movie. I would say that it spends a long time contenting itself to be cute before trying to be very, very serious. But I will say that it got me to go back and put all of Nanni Moretti's movies in my Netflix queue.
Right.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Because it has Michelle Piccoli, right?
Oh, yes, Michelle Piccoli. It actually, Michelle Piccoli does quite a lot to elevate the film, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, he's pretty amazing.
So you said you waited in line or you got to Restless an hour ahead of time and that wasn't good enough.
Oh no, it was.
You have to get to movies like way ahead of time depending on how the hype is. Like how long did you have to wait for Tree of Life, for example?
Tree of Life actually, you know, there's different tiers of films. Tree of Life was actually easier to get into because Tree of Life was a competition premiere in their main theater, the Lumiere. Which means that it's ticketed. Most things at Cannes are not ticketed. You basically just show up whenever, or by whenever I mean, you know, an hour in advance, and it's first come, first served. With some exceptions, press passes and market passes will get you in faster. They have, you know, sort of their own little priority lane. But for Tree of Life, I was able to reserve a spot ahead of time. And had no difficulty getting in. It's an absolutely amazing theater. It's the only theater I've ever gotten vertigo in.
You should see Vertigo in that theater.
Yes, it seats like 2,300 people.
Wow.
Yeah. Cool. Oh, yeah. But most of Cannes, you know, was just a gigantic rush. I was working in the Marché du Film, which is in the basement of the Palais. And the Palais is this sort of this kind of trapezoidal structure sitting on the French Riviera. That I kind of like to liken to Metropolis, because on TV monitors you can see that upstairs, you know, Lars von Trier is giving a press conference and Uma Thurman is walking the red carpet and everything like that, and then down in the basement you have just all the worker bees of the film industry running back and forth giving each other their cards.
Amazing.
My pass did not get me into the priority lanes for the Gus Van Sant film, but it did get me free San Pellegrino, which was nice.
Oh, cool.
Nice. Yeah.
Why not Perrier?
I think San Pellegrino is the official water with bubbles of the Festival de Cannes.
But it's France.
I suppose so. You know, I'm sure there was some sort of backroom deal done.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if I'm going to go to Cannes then. I'm a period man.
Well, just as a sort of side anecdote, I went to a restaurant for lunch, and you know I wanted to keep it small, so that I could hopefully expense it without it being an unreasonable expense.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the waitress asked me what I wanted to drink. I just said tap water, and she seemed a bit confused, so, you know, I just said, you know, just water from a tap. And it hit her, and she said, oh, water of can. And wrote down water de can on the her waitress pad, which is the classiest name for tap water I've ever heard.
Wow.
Does it make it taste better?
It does, actually. It does.
Well, maybe I will go to Cannes.
Every evening, like the Cannes schedule, there's a point every evening generally around, starting at around 4:30, it just becomes a giant madhouse on the cross set. It's impossible to just walk down the street without having to like sort of force your way like a salmon swimming upstream through just a mob of people in tuxedos and evening gowns. And outside the Palais, there are all these people that come down for the weekend and hold up signs saying, "Give me a ticket, please," for all the people who got tickets but ended up having to bail for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
Including one, a young French woman who was holding up a sign that was making a Twin Peaks reference. And she asked me if I thought David Lynch would be at the festival.
No, I didn't
have the heart to tell her that. I mean, I just sort of told her that he didn't have a film in competition, but that he may be here because, you know, he's...
Well, amazing.
Let her on, man. She probably, like, killed herself when she found out he wasn't there.
How are, like, audiences there? Because that's, like, one of the interesting things of film festivals for, like, me and Adam, at least, of just, like, you know, going to the Vancouver Film Festival, and then all of a sudden, you know, all of, you have hundreds of people who care about the newest Kiarostami film or something, and
in
a city where the deck usually is just like seven patrons a night.
Oh yeah.
So like, audience reception, like, was it?
I have to say, I absolutely love the film festival experience, and I've been to film festivals. This is by far the biggest I've ever been to. You know, I've been to mostly smaller film festivals like the Brooklyn Film Festival and the Santa Barbara Film Festival. And what I absolutely love about them is, A, that the audiences are so much more, I guess you'd use the word, like, receptive or sensitive. They seem to feel the film more. You know, I almost get this jaded perception of, you know, the average movie theater where people file in, see the movie, and then silently file out. Whereas at film festivals, people are actually responding to the movie much more, and are much more social about it. Like, it's you know, at the beginning of every screening, you strike up a conversation with the person sitting next to you, which you can never do in just a regular movie theater. So I absolutely love it for that reason. I think Cannes Film Festival audiences are also, it's impossible to address this without addressing the fact that films get booed at Cannes.
Yeah.
So in addition,
are they odd, like, in general, though? Is it just booing, or is there, like, other sort of, you know, audible responses from the audience throughout the movie?
There are very audible responses throughout the movie, in just the right ways. You know, audiences at Cannes, I found, laugh at things you're supposed to laugh at and gasp at things you're supposed to gasp at.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when I went to see Tree of Life, you could tell that it was also an inside the industry screening, because all the various logos that came up for distributors and production companies got applause. They would get like smatters, like sort of spatterings of applause, and then eventually when it got to the last one and there was even more applause, you could hear like the other half of the theater start to go shh. So it would all settle down, and it was just this, you know, tremendous amount of reverence for you know, you could just feel this, you could feel 2,300 people in anticipation waiting to see a movie like Tree of Life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I imagine that would be pretty amazing.
Yeah. Okay. Should we go to that, then?
So did people boo by screening you were at?
No one booed at the screening I was at. I suppose, yeah, we should... Yeah, it... Tree of Life at the 8:30 a.m. screening, which is when the press goes, so they can have their reviews up by the end of the day. Tree of Life got booed. And I don't think anything is more quintessentially Cannes than a film getting booed and then winning the top prize.
When
I tell people that the film got booed, everybody asks me what was so bad about it. Or like, oh my God, was it really awful? And, you know, getting booed at Cannes, as I'm sure you know, is not historically a novel thing to happen. You know, it's happened to a fair amount of films that are now considered to be like mainstays of the canon. I think it mostly just means that people who've been waiting a week to see a movie and then standing in line for 2 hours get kind of impatient. And actually, I have it from an inside source who was at the screening that it really wasn't like a lot of booing. It was just a few people being very vocal.
Right.
So I guess that's sort of the darker side of audiences being more receptive and participatory. They both respond more audibly and voice their and feel more emboldened to voice their displeasure directly.
Mm-hmm. No matter what, it's coming from a place of passion.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I don't know how I feel about it until I experience it for myself, but I'm not necessarily opposed to it.
And it's a conversation starter, like.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So, life.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Tree of Life. Yeah, all right. Okay. All right. Ask me a question about Tree of Life.
Okay. Let's. We can start vague and then maybe
right.
work our way and narrow our questions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How was it?
The best way I can answer this is the same way I answered it the first time someone asked me. After the show, yes. I ran into a friend, and he asked me, you know, how was the film? And I said, now I know what the first audience to see 2001 A Space Odyssey felt like. It's like that. I said that at the start of the film, you could feel 2,300 people, like, bristling in anticipation. By the end of the film, I felt at least a good solid 1,600 of them feeling totally confused.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a film that is by design absolutely gigantic. In fact, the two other works of art I've seen it compared to are Andrei Tarkovsky's The Mirror, which more about that in a moment. As just the Sistine Chapel, as just this, and it's not an inapt comparison, just a gigantic, epically sized monument to man's relationship with God.
Mm.
And when I say God, I should specify that it's a film that is unashamedly spiritual, but not particularly denominational.
Yeah,
I mean, we actually just watched part two of the New World video essay by Matt Solar Seitz,
mm-hmm.
and he describes Malick's sort of portrayal of God as something beyond religion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which I
think is a perfect way of saying it.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, Malick, it's about finding, it's sort of God with a lowercase g, God as a force
mm-hmm.
that exists within nature and within people. But yeah, it's, you know, pretty much every review that I've seen of Tree of Life has used the word cosmic. So I guess the challenge is to review Tree of Life without using the word cosmic, which is tricky.
I'll do my
have you guys seen it? Has it opened there yet?
No, I'll be seeing it next weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Not this coming weekend, but the weekend after, and I will be writing on it for sure. I mean,
I think
it's every critic's duty to tackle Tree of Life.
Mm.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So. Well, you know, even it's getting overwhelmingly positive reviews at the moment, even though the initial reaction was mixed. But you can tell just from looking at the reviews that even the critics who are praising it can't quite tell what to make of it just yet.
Yeah.
Tchaikovsky's piece on Tree of Life is probably the best I've read, just on tackling the film at an interesting and unique level.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Adi's coming from a point of view of not being a big Terrence Malick fan,
mm-hmm.
but from that perspective, I think he does the best he could.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And,
What is he? I haven't read the essay yet, but what does he point out as like the flaws? Because he makes in the At the Movies episode, he makes it sound like it's almost like objectively flawed. Like,
oh, really? In the At the Movies, make it sound perfect.
Really? No,
yeah.
He's like
he calls it one of the most ambitious films.
He calls it one of the most ambitious films, but he says elements.
Ambitious is an adjective along with cosmic that I've seen in almost every review because it's, I guess, something that nobody can deny. It seems like what no critic can deny is. The gigantic scope of the film, the beauty and the absolute sincerity of it that make it just such an absolute rarity. I think actually the film's very existence is kind of miraculous in a lot of ways and almost paradoxical the reception it's been receiving in the, well, not the reception, but kind of paradoxical, the buzz it's been getting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people here have, I mean, people like outside the cinephilia community have heard of it and have heard buzz about it. In fact, when I was flying back, the woman sitting on the plane, the woman sitting next to me on the plane was reading a review of it in Us Weekly. You know, I think that it's
right. It's because it
has Brad Pitt in it, but that's what's so interesting is that within the structure of Hollywood, Terrence Malick essentially made an incredibly personal, a very personal essay film that undoubtedly has probably greater meaning to him than it will have to audiences. If only because he seems
that's
very...
That's actually what Ignati makes.
Yeah.
Well, it's because he doesn't... You know, without giving anything away, because this happens within the first 10 minutes of the film, there's an announcement that one of the sons in this family is dead.
Yeah.
And autobiographically, something similar did happen in Terrence Malick's family. But in the film, we never really learn anything about... the boy who died. In fact, we don't even really know which of his brothers it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, Ignati points that almost as a flaw, actually.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, it's hard to... I mean, that I think was, you know, the mood when I would talk to other cinephiles after the show was that everybody could see that there was a lot of masterful filmmaking at work, but whether or not the film was a masterpiece or a gigantic and beautiful folly is something that I think we knew only time could tell.
Mm-hmm.
This
type of movie.
You use the term essay film. Would you consider it essayistic?
Both yes and no. It's almost a stream of consciousness as Godard, but it's intellect. It's very intellectual in its own way, but it's also very sensual. I say essay film because it's very keen on demonstrating intellectual ideas. But not so keen on the what we think of as drama. You know, there isn't actually an exchange of dialogue spoken on screen until probably about the 40-minute mark.
Oh wow!
Yeah, a lot of voiceover. So I guess maybe not
until then.
Yeah, I mean, so maybe not so much an essay film, so much as a poem, a very impressionistic poem with sort of snatches of voiceover here and there.
Right.
Sort of that just very quick lines that hint at Terrence Malick's worldview, and then that worldview is demonstrated through imagery.
Right.
So, you know, I've seen some people, I've seen a critic describe it as on the nose, which is a, you know, a screenwriting term for being too obvious. But I think that just goes to show how little Tree of Life has to do with conventional notions of screenwriting. To be honest, if you told me the film didn't even have a screenplay at all, that wouldn't surprise me.
Well, yeah, I mean, Malick has always made his movies in a way where he has a screenplay that he works from that's completely built on narrative, and then he deletes that by the time the movie's done.
Oh, yes.
So, like, he'll just take chunks out, and then you sort of take away anything to, you know, leave it as a comfortable narrative film or something with character arcs in any, you know, traditional sense of a character arc.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Namely to, like, I think he does have to, like, construct the moments he likes most in movies just so he can have those instead of the dialogue in the name of getting there.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and then kind of slips those in between one another and whatnot.
Though, you know, I will say that this is Terrence Malick at his most Malick. This is him taking that style of filmmaking the farthest I've seen it go.
Yeah.
And I think that the what critics and audiences are sort of having to come to terms with is whether that style of filmmaking should go this far. I actually heard reports that there was about 8 hours of footage that he wanted to use. The final film was 2.5 hours, so he definitely had to lose a lot that he liked. But in many ways, it does feel a bit, at times, like an undisciplined film.
Right.
A film that where he ended up with a lot of footage and tried to include everything that he liked.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. That doesn't sound like the same filmmaker who made The Thin Red Line.
No, and it didn't feel like the same filmmaker who... Well, it did, but it didn't feel like Days of Heaven, which I thought did a very good job of balancing Terrence Malick's style with the narrative.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, I put that criticism on The New World. I feel like, especially because it gets fairly narrative-heavy once they have to go to... just to hit certain plot points, like going to England and whatnot, and it kind of chews some of the plein air poetic elements of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
For me, at least.
Well, it's... You know, as the Tree of Life is a film that deals in a dichotomy, the dichotomy between, as it says in a voiceover in the very beginning, nature and grace.
Mm-hmm.
Symbolically between the kind of...
The father.
The father and the mother, but also between the kind of Darwinian, the sort of cutthroat Darwinian aspect of nature and the beautiful transcendent aspect of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so the movie is basically an essay about that and a metaphor and a metaphor for how God relates to man, and a drama about a family in Texas. It's many things at once. But
yeah. Well, this film's always been about reconciling those two things you're mentioning, your interpretation of what nature and grace are within the film. That's what his movies have always been about.
Oh, yeah.
How each is inherent in one another.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. No,
But films don't, like, end on, like, a grand statement that I gather Tree of Life does.
Oh,
you know?
Tree of
like,
Life.
It just...
Tree of Life ends on... on a very grand statement. I actually found it to be more kind of like 8.5, but instead of a playful Nina Rota score, just sort of a great booming thundering symphony.
Right.
Right, that's interesting. I mean, I've read almost everything on The Tree of Life, and everything that critics point out as a negative part of the film at this point has pretty much secured my confidence in how good it'll be. because I've disagreed with most of the ways critics are taking the movie. The only thing that has troubled me so far is I've read about the final sequence. We won't talk about it here so as not to spoil it for others, but the final sequence is the only thing where I can't see how it cannot be problematic.
Well,
for me.
I will say this. You know, I spoke with an old friend of mine who's also a cinephile and had been awaiting the film, and he asked me if... Because he'd heard rumors that the ending was sentimental, which is it's an ugly word among cinephiles, sort of signifying the whorish Hollywood tendency to fake happy emotion to sell more tickets.
Yep.
And I think that sentimental would be a really unfair word to use. It would be like describing like Alexander Sakharov's Mother and Son as sentimental. It's sincere, positive emotions in a lot of ways, but done in far too personal and abstract a way to be classified as something like false uplift or giving the people what they want.
Right. Well, no, I mean, nothing I've read has suggested that it's sentimental, and it feels weird to be talking about the end of a movie I haven't seen yet,
yeah.
But it is the one thing that I'm, like, really worried about, because it seems completely at odds with how I read Malick in some ways, and his style. So I'm kind of worried about that, but at the same time, I won't know until I experience it. But Ignati actually talks about the ending as sort of how you're saying, that it's so personal that it kind of evades being too grand a statement and ends up being more of a personal thing, which makes me feel a little better. But
oh yeah,
I mean, what is the ending an issue for you, or do you find it powerful or problematic or what?
I found it powerful. I mean, I didn't find it any more problematic than the rest of the film. It's strange to think of it as an ending per se. It's really much easier to compare Tree of Life to a musical symphony than to a narrative film. It didn't feel so much like the ending as the final movement of a symphony. And I almost saw it as it was a way to wrap things up. It was a grand finale, and I think that there's a question on whether or not the film is too big in a lot of ways, by which I don't mean too long, but just reaching for such grandeur that it'll keep people at arm's length.
Right.
Well, yeah, that's another thing that has slightly worried me, is that everyone's making such a big deal about the cosmological aspect of the film.
Yeah.
And so what worries me a little bit is that the cosmological side of the film actually makes an appearance, whereas I think it's actually in his four previous films, but it's in his four previous films in a veiled way.
Yeah, just like a suggestion.
Oh, well, this is the most direct. I think this film is probably the most direct Terrence Malick has ever been. You know, there's always that undertone, even in Days of Heaven, which, I mean, you could practically pitch Days of Heaven. You know, you could give that plot summary in 25 words or less. It wouldn't be a fair summary of the film, but it would be something to go on. And you really can't in Tree of Life, but the undertones of nature as this gigantic organism that dwarfs man, that's sort of a thinly veiled subtext in other Malick films, is practically the subject of the film for very long stretches of it.
Right.
I mean, for those out there in Radioland, this is a film that at one point cuts to a silent sequence that must take about 20 minutes showing the origins of life on Earth. That's it. I think that in this film, what will throw a lot of people off, I think, and surprise even Terrence Malick admirers, is that his other films, Man's Place in Nature, there was just this assumed context, and in Tree of Life he feels the need to demonstrate that context by literally going back and showing the origins of life.
Right.
Rather than let that be just sort of a given that sort of hovers over the proceedings and the foibles of Colin Farrell / Richard Gere / the cast of The Thin Red Line.
Yeah.
Have you read Richard Brody's interpretation of The Tree of Life?
I'm afraid not, actually. I don't believe so.
Because he makes a unique argument that has been now backed up by Matt Solar-Sykes, who's sort of an authority on Malick. And we'll see if you can see it from his point of view. He thinks that the film is all about remembering, and it's about memories. And when you take it in that context, all the images of the origin of the universe and dinosaurs and all those things, he doesn't see them as Malick literally showing us what happened. He sees it as an adult remembering how he imagined these things as a child and how he tried to fit these things into his reality.
Oh yes, and I agree. And I agree that it's very much a film about memory. In fact, Sean Penn doesn't really have much action for himself to do. Sean Penn's role in the movie largely consists of wandering around and giving context to the images that follow.
I hear that he rides an elevator.
I think it's an escalator, actually. So
escalator, okay.
And then he wanders around in a desert. But I do think, actually, I found the movie surprisingly clear in a lot of ways. The impressionistic voiceover does actually provide sort of skeleton keys for understanding what the film is about. At one point, I believe the mother says, unless you learn to love, your life will flash by.
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
gives this element of soulfulness to to Sean Penn, who we've seen as a child, but we've seen nothing in between his childhood and adulthood. And it's like his childhood has come back in a rush, but everything that happened since has just been complete non-existence.
Mm-hmm. So do you think thematic statements are being made in the narration track?
Which... Oh, very, very much so. In fact, yeah. I think that if there's a flaw to the film, and this is what... In fact, I'm not sure it's a flaw, but I don't think it's something that can really be denied, is that the film makes it a point to state its thematic and philosophical assertions, albeit in a sort of coded poetic way, rather than demonstrating them through what we think of as action, because there really isn't much action. It's you can look at the trailer for Tree of Life, which is one of the most beautiful trailers I've ever seen, and those images don't really have much more context in the film itself than they do in the trailer, because
right.
the film itself is just basically one long flow of images.
Yeah.
But see, that's what doesn't fit in with my vision of Malick, and that's why, you know, when I read all these critics accusing the narration of literalizing the film's themes and ideas, I can't take their writing seriously, and of course I can't say anything until I've seen the movie, but it doesn't fit in with Malick's previous movies, where narrators, even if sometimes they come close to articulating something Malick's getting at, like the closest would be Jim Caviezel's character in Thin Red Line,
mm-hmm.
But they never actually literalize the themes. What they do is offer windows into individual perspectives on ideas without actually... It's more of the collective sort of experience of the images and an individual perspective through narration that creates Malick's ideas.
Okay. Well,
I'm saying the tree looks like the characters are the ideas, whereas in...
That's never been the case.
Yeah, in the Thin Red Line, they are... characters around the idea.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Yes. Well, it's. I will say that I agree with your statement about Malick for Days of Heaven. In particular, I love the little girl's narration in Days of Heaven.
Of course.
Which serves various different functions at different points throughout the film, but in many ways, rather than showing this cosmically all-knowing point of view, shows a very
naive.
Very naive, mm-hmm. Yes. It shows that sort of as a human, she only has a very limited view of the action, whereas the characters in the voiceovers in the Tree of Life make incredibly grand philosophical assertions that it's clear the film supports.
Right.
But I will say this, Tree of Life, it's a lot of things. You know, on the one hand, I would say you can't escape it as a metaphor about man and God. You know, just the shot of Brad Pitt looking at his newborn baby, it creates this kind of metaphorical family unit where the parents mm-hmm. are God and the children are man.
Mm-hmm.
And you see how...
It's not being a metaphor. That strikes me as being how a child actually looks at their
absolutely.
Parents.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, well, and then when they're... That's what's so great about it, because it functions both as a literal drama... and as a metaphorical statement. And, you know, I wouldn't be so inclined to see it as a metaphorical statement about God if not for the fact that it has, you know, the 20-minute sequence of the origins of life and very clearly tries to draw a parallel between life originating on Earth and life originating in this family. But it takes just basically the arc of a coming-of-age story, like reliance and love on parents with fear and suspicion of it, and then eventually just kind of drifting away from them, and turns it into a metaphor for man's relationship with God, which you could argue, looking at the film, that the film is stating that relationship has followed a similar arc.
Mm-hmm.
And now I worry that I sound like I'm going to start handing out pamphlets on a religion or something, which I assure you is not the case. But it's a film, what I think that Terrence Malick is an absolute master at, is giving you, is conveying abstract ideas through imagery in a very visceral and direct way.
Mm-hmm.
Like you look at like an image of a young boy holding his hand up in the rain, and you understand the greater meaning of it, I guess.
Yeah.
That here, that's what I should call my Tree of Life review, the greater meaning of it, I guess. That just about sums it up.
We should probably record another podcast after we've actually seen the film, so we can actually talk about it in a meaningful way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But,
well, I need to see it again as well. You know, at Cannes, there was this this feeling of newness. You know, it was, you know, the wonderful thing about it at Cannes is that you walk in completely blind. You know, you haven't read any reviews of it. You don't know any initial reactions. I mean, your reaction is the initial reaction. It's almost exhilarating.
Mm-hmm.
But it would help to see it again.
Yeah, I mean, based on my experiences with movies that I anticipate as highly as The Tree of Life, my first screening almost has to be written off because my heart is pounding to the point where I can hear it. And, like, and I sweat profusely. Like, that was my experience, I think, with seeing, like, Uncle Boomy. And whenever it's a film that I'm really excited for, the first viewing is just, like, an experience almost outside of the movie of like, yes, I'm seeing it! So I'm probably going to see the film twice in opening weekend.
Oh, yeah.
And I won't be able to form any proper thoughts until after the second viewing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd love to go back and see it once. You know, once you know where a film is going, it's much easier to see the reason for everything along the way.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I just saw Meek's Cut Off for the first time, and that is a film where you can only, I think, properly watch that film when you already know all its cards that's going to show you throughout it, and you know that from the very beginning.
Yeah.
So I assume The Tree of Life is somewhat similar in that regard.
Oh, very much so. I mean, I think it's amazing that it's a sign of how incredibly well-regarded Terrence Malick is, that it not only got made, but got made starring an A-lister and didn't get cut, and is getting released by a subsidiary of a major studio, and is getting enough buzz that it was trending. It was one of the top 10 searches on Yahoo a few days ago. I have no idea. I have no idea what audiences are going to make of it when it comes out.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are going to call it pretentious.
I was at Meek's Cutoff, and the Tree of Life trailer played before Meek's Cutoff, and a woman behind me halfway through the trailer said, "That is pretentious."
Which I find pretentious is a word that I would love to see retired from criticism. Just because in many cases it's technically true, but doesn't have any bearing on the film whatsoever.
Yeah.
I mean, any film that says anything meaningful is pretentious. And there are good pretentious films and bad pretentious films.
Yeah. And many times when people use that word, they themselves are being pretentious because they want something to be at their level when it's not or something, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think I agree with that. They're denying the assertion of the film so absolutely that they themselves are being just as
you can't make a movie
assertion.
About God, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Tree of Life... I mean, Tree of Life. That you know, that I've gotten in all sorts of debate lately on how valid auteur theory was, and on how much you can really say that the director is the author of a film, not the author, but the sole author, or that the film represents the director. And I can say that with Tree of Life, I mean, auteur theory is alive and well. I mean, this movie is Terrence Malick. It's Terrence Malick's film. It's Terrence Malick's thoughts and emotions, and being a movie in the conventional sense of what people are looking for is just not on its agenda. This movie is what Terrence Malick wants to say, and I highly doubt it bothers him who wants to listen.
Well, should we shift topics then?
Yeah, okay.
Worst movie you saw at Con?
Yeah, what was the worst film?
I didn't really see anything bad. I did see I went to a midnight screening of a Kung Fu movie.
Oh, yeah. Was that Wuxia?
Wuxia.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're finding Chinese pronunciation.
I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Wuxia!
It's kind of a... it's kind of an action comedy where my two, well, an action comedy mystery meditation on what it's like to have an overbearing father, not unlike Tree of Life, actually. So it's Tree of Life with sort of like ultra-violent slow motion fight scenes, and
right.
The two problems I have with it, is sort of a specific and a general problem. My specific problem is that this was my first Donnie Yen film. Donnie Yen being a choreographer and a martial artist, and
right.
I didn't find him to be a very charismatic screen presence.
Mm-hmm.
He just looked kind of blank the whole time. My more
right.
general problem was that when everything that happens on screen feels random, it's hard for me to get too invested in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a movie that just sort of goes wildly careening from direction to direction.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then, okay, now he's faking dead, now he's popping up and cutting his own arm off, now the villain is getting struck by lightning, it just...
Sounds awesome.
Goes by.
So I guess, so that's the worst film, but it was still good.
It was still good, yeah. I mean, I didn't see anything bad. I actually didn't see many films at all. I only saw 5 during my time at Cannes. Plus 2
right.
more after the festival ended, thanks to a kind of a listserv that they posted film links on.
Right. So what was your favorite then?
My favorite would probably have to be Tree of Life, but that's just such an incredibly obvious pick that I would have to go one down on the list and say Miss Bala. But since I've also already talked about Miss Bala, I would have to go yet another one down the list and give a shout out to a Russian film called Elena.
Yeah. Okay.
Which won? I think it won the runner up prize in the in certain regards section.
Right. Cool.
So yeah.
So wait, you. I mean, I know we shouldn't dwell on it, but it is
right.
the main topic. But you do find the Tree of Life to be like intrinsically flawed, right? Like you do think it has issues.
All I can say for sure is that I don't think. I don't think at the moment that I can call it a gigantic masterpiece. And, normally that doesn't mean much, except the film very clearly is aiming to look and feel like a gigantic masterpiece. I mean, this is a film that aims to be about nothing less than the sweep of life itself, not just personal life, but all life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I certainly, you know, it feels unfair to call it flawed. You know,
mm-hmm.
it would be like looking at, I don't know, it would be like a, what's, I'm trying to think.
I know what kind of allegorical statement you're reaching for.
I mean, the fact that it even exists is so incredibly special
to it,
that
extent.
You know, there are definitely things about it that I would that I don't feel entirely comfortable with, but I'll have to see it a second time before really coming to any definitive conclusions about about specific points of the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there are things that I wish that he did more to establish character. Like the character of Sean Penn as an adult, or the characters of the brothers. But I think that it's such a magnificent idiosyncratic beast that you just sort of have to take the flaws for what they are. And
yeah.
I mean, I'm not even comfortable saying that, because I'm not sure I would call them flaws. I would more of call them particularities.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's put a cap on it. That's the Tree of Life.
Yeah.
All right.
No more Tree of Life. I think we've said enough. I think we've covered a lot.
Yeah.
I'm actually impressed with how much we were able to generate in a discourse without having seen the movie.
Yeah. Definitely.
No, no. I felt you guys had more to say about it than I did.
Do we want to cap off with the final question then? Or?
Well, let's just let it get loose, y'all. But I do have a question. Daniel Kasman of the movie Notebook says that the Cannes Film Festival is a horrible place to watch movies, and having been to the festival several times, claims to have never had fun. So, someone who has now been to the Cannes Film Festival, do you at all, from your point of view, agree with his statements that it's a bad place to watch movies, that it's a place you ultimately can't have fun? And also, having witnessed Daniel Kasdan at a Cannes Film Festival, can you verify that this man does not have fun in France?
Well, I will testify. I was actually, I came to a similar conclusion about the Cannes Film Festival not being a good place to watch films, but I guess the rush of being there for my first time still hasn't worn off. I think that, if I'm lucky enough to get to go back, it'll probably set in, because there's a lot about the film festival that really makes it a very flawed environment to watch films. I mean, you have to queue up an hour before the show. There's a lot of, it's basically you have to, go through airport security every time you want to go to a movie. You don't have to take off your shoes and unpack your bag, but there's a lot about the festival that makes it a bad environment. There's a lot of lines. It's hard to get into screenings. It's harder to get a good seat. There's a sense that it's a very market-oriented. It's a very market-oriented screening, a very market-oriented festival. And in fact, in a lot of ways, I enjoy something like the Santa Barbara Film Festival even more, a place that was not oriented towards making sales or yielding major discoveries, but just simply being a community event.
You should join us at VIF.
Yeah, I would love to. No, that would be great. But, it's hard to complain when you're at Cannes, and when you get to see these movies, some of which will probably never get any sort of meaningful release in the United States, and you get to see them before much of the world has. So it's hard to complain. You just sort of go along with it. But I will say, I was there for a week, and I don't think I could have taken another week.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It would just...
So how are the parties?
I only went to one. I only went to one, and it was enough to last me for a week. Let's just say, I understand why La Dolce Vita won the top prize 50 years ago. Just because after getting out of the movie, everybody kind of lived it for a week. This amount of intense glamour that just leaves you exhausted.
Right.
You're just sort of surrounded by beautiful people, who are looking to get into exclusive parties and everything like that. At one party, I was talking to a girl, and she asked me if I had Coke.
Oh, wow.
So
did you do Coke at Cannes?
I'm sorry?
Did you do some Coke at Cannes?
No. Oh, God, no. I don't even, I didn't even get drunk.
Yeah, it was a joke.
It was a joke, don't worry.
Okay. What was
it?
No, what was funny about it? It was a girl. It was a girl I was talking to at the official movie party. Maybe this should be left out of the podcast. And I was talking with her. I was talking with her, and I was talking very much like I am now, just kind of fast, sort of stream of consciousness, trying to gather my thoughts. And she just suddenly perked up and said, "Oh, do you have Coke? You're talking fast." And then she looked absolutely mortified that she'd asked that.
So are people talking about movies and stuff at these parties?
Oddly, no. Everybody seemed kind of burned out. Burned out of movies. I would try to talk about it a bit, but it seemed like there's the movie life and then there's the social life. And I got the sense that a lot of the people that I was meeting at parties weren't necessarily cinephiles. I joke that you can tell who the PR people are at Cannes because they look exhausted and they don't actually want to see any of the films.
And I guess that demographics at all film festivals, because we've had our share of interesting experiences at VIF and whatnot.
Oh yeah.
Like Certified Coffee, for example. you swear that when that movie ended, people just thought they saw like a romantic comedy or something.
It was, totally.
Had a few existential meanderings in between. Was there a question we should have asked you?
Is there? Oh, good question.
Are you gonna use that question when you're interviewing like big name directors?
Actually, I stole this. I was watching some Con coverage, and this guy asked this question. I'm like, shit, that is like the best question to go to, and you have no more questions. So this is
All right, rocket.
This is the first time testing, so go.
Oh well, you didn't ask me where you can get really, really good carbonara.
What is carbonara?
Oh, it's a type of pasta.
Oh, okay.
There's this really great really great brasserie right across from the Palais. Definitely check it out.
Cool. Well,
I'll head there after the recording.
No, no, that was a surprising lethargic response for a joke. On my part, if you're gonna tell a joke, don't tell it lethargically. What movie did you most want to see but couldn't see?
Yeah, that's a good one.
The biggest surprise. Actually, I heard a lot of buzz about The Artist.
Okay.
Sadly, you know, it's actually kind of hard to see competition films, because most of them play once and then play. Most of them play a few times on opening day in the same theater where you need a ticket, and then play once the morning after, and then after that just aren't present in the festival at all.
Right.
But I really wanted to see The Artist, and that, it seemed, just from the general buzz I heard, was one of the surprise pleasures. You know, maybe mostly because it was the best film that didn't come from, you know, the Dardenne brothers or Lars von Trier or Neri Bilt-Ceylan. It looks to be a very interesting film, and it won the Best Actor award. And it was actually the first competition film that didn't have distribution but picked up distribution at Cannes.
Cool. I don't know, I was a little nervous about that one, just because, like, I feel like if you're going to revisit the silent film format, you have to kind of investigate the form in order not to be nostalgic, and that it really just kind of reeked of nostalgia to me. Just the trailer. But specifically, like, what Guy Mann does with silent films, there's not an inch of nostalgia, because he's reinterpreting them. Whereas that was just like, I don't know.
The movie that mostly came to mind when I saw the trailer was Singing in the Rain. Just because it's about movie stars in the silent era, but also a similar tone. And I think that nostalgia, it's certainly not as vital as somebody like Guy Madden. But if it's heartfelt and sincere, I think it can be what Francois Truffaut called the joy of cinema.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Cool. Well, should we end on that note?
Yeah, end on a Truffaut quote. That seems appropriate.
I'm down with it.
So thank you for joining us for the first time, and hopefully we more episodes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This has been Cinema Sleuths. I'm Duncan Gray.
Kurt Walker.
Adam Cook.
And we'll see you next time.